Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Coffee and Crime, a true crime podcast. If you're new here, hi, hello, how you doing? My name is Lisa Marie, and each week I sit down with a cup of coffee and I tell you all a true crime story. Now, quick apology for ghosting for the last 2 weeks. Life and work have just been hella busy. Okay, it just has, and I've been a bit swamped, but I'm back, baby. Plus, researching for this week's bonus episode has been wild. It's been full on. I find one thing, it leads me down to another thing. It's just chaotic. But with that being said, welcome, hi, hello, to this cute little bonus episode where we're going to pull apart Carl Panzram a bit more. Because we're not over this guy yet. I wish we were, but we're not. We have some more things to discuss. The last two episodes covered his story and what a frightening person he was. So if you've tuned in for the first time and thinking, wait, what? Who the hell is Carl Panzram? Then please go and listen to the last two episodes and then come back. But all in all, he was a pretty horrific dude. So maybe just join next week, which will be a much lighter case. It is also a case that has been recommended by one of the lovely listeners, so that'll be a lot of fun. Now, this week in this bonus episode, it's gonna be a little bit chaotic, I'm not gonna lie. It's gonna be fun. It's gonna be like key events in Carl's life, and we're going to pull apart, we're going to talk about some behavioural things. I don't actually really know how this is going to go, we're just going to wing it. I'm going to try and sound all smart, it's not going to happen. Some things to keep in mind though, and to remember, also I suppose a little bit of a disclaimer, all the psychology knowledge that we're going to discuss today has come out way after Carl's time. This stuff wasn't around, and the studies weren't done then, but they have been done now, and they're always being done, and we're always discovering new things. So nothing with Carl is absolute, and because no one with modern day knowledge like spoke to him or interviewed him or diagnosed him, there is nothing absolute. And I am not here today to diagnose Carl. I am not an expert in any medical field, nor even in psychology, but I studied it alongside criminology, so this is out of pure fascination. Anything that I talk about in today's episode, you're more than welcome to discuss with me, and you can get in touch with me on Instagram or Facebook at Coffee and Crime Podcast, or you can send me an email at coffeeandcrimepod@gmail.com, and we can discuss anything. But apparently my intros are getting too long. Someone has commented that, so taking it on board. So, lovely listeners of Coffee and Crime, grab your cup of coffee or whatever caffeinated beverage you need to get through your day and join me as we discuss the psychology of Carl Panzram. Warning, the following episode contains adult language and discussion on all of Carl Panzram's monstrous crimes. For the full list of triggers, please listen to part 1 and part 2 of Carl Panzram's story. This podcast is recommended for listeners 16 years and above. Listener discretion is advised. So while I do have key points and, you know, discussion points to bring up, this is actually more or less an unscripted episode. It's going to be quite different for me. I'm actually sitting on my couch rather than my recording desk, just to make it feel like a bit more freestyle, a bit more chat-like, I suppose. You know, I'm drinking my coffee, I'm just recording, having a chat. I don't know. That's the kind of vibe we're going for today. And like I said, I've got key points, things that I've actually pulled from research papers and articles, and they will all be linked in the show notes as per usual. But then some of it will kind of be a little bit like my own interpretations and thoughts, which yes, they are my own. And like I've just said, you are more than welcome to discuss them with me. There is no right and wrong. It's thoughts, it's opinions, it's interpretations. It's what I love to talk about. So with that being said, I'm going to start us off with a quote from one of the websites I was researching called Psychiatry Advisor. And it was this article blog type post written by a Dr. Nicola Davies, and the article was called From Abused Child to Serial Killer, Investigating Nature vs. Nurture and Methods of Murder. Now, of course, this is the oldest argument in the book about murderers, serial killers, mass murderers, and I suppose just all in all bad people, right? Like, is it their environment or were they just born bad, I suppose? And Dr. Davies says this, quote, "Not all abused children will become serial killers, and not all serial killers are victims of childhood abuse. However, the connection between the two cannot be dismissed as just coincidence," end quote. So we know that Carl Panzram was born into hardship, right? He was born into a large but poor family, immigrants to the US. They worked on a really shit farm that just didn't grow anything. And his parents, Johann and Matilda, they didn't show any love to their kids whatsoever. They were born to be workers on the farm, free labor, even though the farm was it was a dirt farm. It wasn't growing anything. And they were poor. They were struggling to put food on the table, let alone make any money. It wasn't fantastic. And because the parents, Johann and Matilda, showed no love to the kids, straight away we can see that the nurture side to Carl is starting to falter. Now, actually, another point that I will just quickly mention, when I do any kind of comparison of Carl's life to a normal life, or saying Carl is a child compared to a normal child, please note that I do mean like quote-unquote normal, you know, like with a family, like there is no abuse, there's no disabilities, both parents are in the home, like that conventional family. That's what I mean when I'm comparing it. I don't even know really where the idea of a quote-unquote normal conventional family comes from, because no family is really like that. Everyone has got something. So I don't really know, but I'm saying it because if I was to compare every discussion point today to a normal family and a blended family and a solo parent family and a family with parents who identify as part of the LGBTQIA plus community, or a child as part of the LGBTQIA plus community, and compare it as well to different racial families, that would just be far too difficult to be able to pull all that research. And it would also make this episode about 6-7 hours long. So I'm not meaning to be insensitive or leave anyone out. I just want to get through this episode. And yeah, so I just want to put that out there. I don't want anyone to take offense if you feel like I'm leaving anyone out. I'm really, really not. So I want to jump to when Carl is around 5-6 years old, because this is when he starts stealing and lying. Now, yes, kids lie. It is a very common, very normal thing to happen. And it usually starts around the age of 3, when a quote-unquote normal child has their speech pattern set in. They're now forming longer sentences, telling stories, really mimicking the attitude of those around them within the household. Now, obviously, the reason for lying for kids is that they don't get in trouble and they want to hide something from their parents. They also do it as a form of like attention seeking, not necessarily this like, oh, look at me type of attention, but children need constant attention. So if they're lacking that in the home, they'll take any kind, whether it positive or negative. So that's another reason why children lie. Now, usually between the ages of 5 to 8 years old, this is when children learn that lying is naughty and shouldn't be done. Now, that's not to say that they're never going to lie. They do slip up every now and again. But usually as a parent, you just have to like ask a few more questions and press for details. And then usually they tell the truth because they haven't thought all of it out yet. But Carl became a very prolific liar at this age, and he learned very quickly what tone of voice to use and facial expressions, which wasn't really hard because, oh God, Carl was an angry, mean child. And this was because of getting constantly beaten up by his brothers, being worked to death on the farm, and having no sleep and still expected to do a full day of school. He definitely was not a happy camper, so he probably had a face like a smacked ass, to be honest. And I don't blame him. I really don't, because that's not how you should be raising your kids, and it is abuse and it's terrible. However, it is also kind of a red flag that he has gained these skills of how to lie at this age because it's not being weaned out. Now, according to a Dr. Carol Brady, who's a clinical psychologist, lying after learning it's not a desired behavior could potentially be a symptom of ADHD. She says, quote, "One of the hallmarks of the impulsive type of ADHD is to talk before they think, so a lot of times you're going to get this lying issue," end quote. Now, I'm not here to say that if you are diagnosed with ADHD, that's going to make you a horrible serial killer. I hope not. My partner has ADHD, so I'm really hoping that this is not the case. No, we know for a fact that this is not the case. The only reason I bring it up is because one of the reoccurring themes of Carl's story is that he has no diagnosis of anything. There is a lack of it. So even something as common as ADHD, if we can see connections that possibly he did have ADHD as well, it may contribute because he wasn't diagnosed with it, so therefore he couldn't be cared for in a way that helps a person with ADHD to thrive. That's why, like, there'll be a few other mental illnesses and disorders and things that come up that don't necessarily make you a serial killer, but they're all parts of what Carl potentially could have had, and we're just going to chat about them. Now, we do know that through Carl's story, his behavior doesn't get any better. In fact, it continues to deteriorate. And at the age of 8 years old, Carl was arrested for being intoxicated. So between the ages of 6 to 8, there were some big events that happened in the Panzram household. First off, Jean-Paul, his older brother, leaves the farm, quickly followed by his father leaving the farm, which that is quite significant. The father figure has walked out of the home, and, you know, this is late 1800s, early 1900s, so it's a very traditional, you know, men are the ruling figure, everything they say goes. They kind of, in not a very nice way, they are the leader of the house, and now he's gone, everything else starts to kind of fall apart, because after the oldest brother and the father leaves, some of the other brothers leave. Matilda, Carl's mother, becomes really ill. The family farm gets worse, which seems impossible because it was really shit anyway. And then August, who was one of Carl's older brother who stayed on the farm, was constantly beating Carl up for anything and everything. Carl is also dealing with constant ear infections and being undernourished. So he's absolutely miserable and turned to drinking. Now, what's interesting about this is something that we see adults do, right? Unfortunately, you know, oh, money's not good, my partner's left me, my boss is a dick, life's terrible, I can't afford this, I don't have that. And we turn to drink. We turn to drink for a number of reasons. It might numb any pain. It might help you go to sleep because you can't sleep because you're so stressed and anxious and depressed about everything. It helps you forget. If you drink enough, you can black out. And then unfortunately, it can take hold of people and, you know, they're now dealing with alcoholism, and it's terrible and it's awful. There is help out there for people, but back in the early 1900s, I don't think there was that much. Now, from Carl's story, we heard that after his father, Johann, left, he didn't take his alcohol with him. He left it because Carl found it. Now, there are no accounts of how much alcohol was there or how regularly Carl's father drank alcohol. We could probably speculate it was a lot because Carl found the stash and he drank it dry. He went through the whole thing, so maybe a case of monkey see, monkey do. You know, he always might have seen his father drinking, so that's what he's decided to do as well. Carl probably drank the alcohol as well to also let him get some sleep, because if you remember from part one, he was probably only getting 2 hours, 2-3 hours of sleep on a good night. You know what I mean? Because he'd be woken up to do farm work, go to school, come home to do farm work, have dinner, go to sleep, wake up, and it'd be really early in the morning. So yeah, he probably drank it to go to sleep and also maybe to numb any physical pain that he was in from being beaten up and the ear infections. So not ideal. Now, we all know the effect alcohol has on our adult brains. We have vision impairment, we make some questionable decisions like texting our exes and thinking we can sing karaoke when we can't. But we also, you know, we do become aware of these things, and depending on if you drink, how often you drink, you learn your limit. You may not always stick to it, but hey, as long as you're safe, it's fine. But for the underdeveloped brain of Carl Panzram at 8 years old, there are some serious long-lasting effects, and not obviously not just of Carl Panzram, but any drinking underage or with an underdeveloped brain, there are going to be long-lasting effects. There are especially going to be changes to the frontal region where the temporal lobe and the prefrontal cortex are, and these parts of your brain are involved in your working memory, your motor behavior, impulse control, rule learning, spatial learning, planning, and decision making. So I think it's safe to say that now we know that Carl made some pretty bad decisions in his life. Him drinking so much at such an early age probably very likely played a huge role of this. Carl also never learned rules. In fact, he actively sought out to break the rules, and he definitely had no control on his impulses. Now, these weren't like little accidental slip-ups every now and again, but he would actually go and fight boys around town, making bad choices, acting on his impulses, and, you know, learning rules like, no, you don't go around fighting boys. But no, he did this, and this led him to be arrested at the age of 12 and sent to the reform school Red Wing in Minnesota. Before I get to that point, because that place is just, oh, it's like it's a hellhole. There is something I want to talk about first, and that was Carl's botched surgery. Because I think it's also safe to say that that was quite a significant event. So if you remember, Carl experienced severe earaches, infections, and pain, and he had developed mastoiditis, which is an infection of the mastoid bone behind the ear, and you can actually feel your mastoid bone. So this is just a bit random. I was like, where is it? I'm going to find it on my own head. So if you touch your earlobe, and then if you drop down to like the corner of your jaw, and then take your finger and run it towards the back of your head. So you've got that like nice soft squishy part. And then the first kind of hard part you feel is the mastoid bone. And that's where the infection was. Nowadays, it can be treated with antibiotics. You can also have a mastoidectomy, which is where the infected bone is actually removed. Now, it's a pretty major procedure because it is done on the head, but it's quite routine. It has an 80 to 90% success rate. However, with any surgical procedure, there are risks. You know, even in a hospital environment, there are risks because it's still being done by a human, and humans are flawed. And yeah, you're still, and that's why it's a major procedure, because you are dealing with a very, very crucial part of your body, your head. However, from Carl's story, we know that he had it done on the kitchen table in the family farmhouse, where his untrained mother cut into his head with a kitchen knife while his siblings held him down, and there was no form of pain medication, there was no anesthesia, nothing. So first and foremost, like I said, no professional training from Carl's mother whatsoever, so, you know, that's great. Second of all, absolutely no sanitation practicing going on. You know, she probably just washed her hands and the kitchen knife with water, and that water is probably filtered from like farm waste or something. So that's great. But yeah, needless to say, it was botched from the get-go, and after making the incision, Carl's mother then flushed out the area with near-boiling hot water, so right there you've got possibly nerve damage in the open wound, burns on the skin surrounding the incision, and also whatever the water is damaging inside of his head. It's just a lot of trauma going on in that underdeveloped, crucial part of Carl's body. So that's the head trauma. Like I said in part one, you'll find that 9 out of 10 serial killers would have experienced head trauma in their younger years, whether that's being abused, whether that's just a fall, whether it was an accident, whatever the case. I can't think of a single serial killer that I know about that hasn't had head trauma. If you can think of one, please tell me, because that would be super interesting to know, but I can't think of one off the top of my head. So there's Carl's head trauma, and you know, we're just starting to piece things together. However, this still isn't a sure shot guarantee of what he's gonna grow up to be like. You know, there is still hope for Carl at this point because he is only 9 years old. It's not going great, but someone just needs to be nice to him and set him on the right path. But he never got there. He wasn't shown any kindness at home, and there was no one to stop his behavior and curve it, you know, like put him on the right path. And I mean, I'm sure August, his brother, tried to beat it out of him, but that didn't work for Carl. So he carried on his bad behavior. He actually didn't get that infection out. He ended up having to go to hospital to get it sorted, but that's after the trauma had already happened. His decision making, the drinking of alcohol kept going on, so it just wasn't going well for Carl, and it landed him in Red Wing Reform School. So we do have to talk about this place, even though it's absolutely fucking awful. It's just the most depraved, disgusting, and vile place, to be honest. It was this child prison, essentially, that hid behind a facade of religion and this attitude of, we'll set your kids straight type thing. And I mean, unfortunately, a lot of reform schools and other places where children were amassed and kept together and looked after by adults who don't tolerate children or didn't know how to care for them properly have now come to surface, and the absolute horrors are being revealed. And I mean, there was that one in Florida, and the name is on the tip of my tongue. It was a reform school for boys in Florida. It was just absolutely horrific. Starts with D, and you guys are probably all screaming it at me right now. Dozier, the Dozier School for Boys. Oh my goodness, that I listened to a podcast on that, and it just broke me. Like, it was just horrific. You know, boys were being shipped off there and then never being seen again, their families never hearing from them or nothing, and were given absolutely no explanation as to where they had gone or why they disappeared. And it turns out that most of them were being shackled and tortured and then shot and like used as target practice and then buried in mass graves. And it's just, oh, it's just horrendous. In my very humble opinion, anyone who wishes harm on a child comes from a very dark, deep pit of hell. And Red Wing Reform School was no different. They literally had a room dedicated for beatings, and Carl was taken there on his first day, and he hadn't even done anything wrong. He was just taken there, and they called it the painting room because the boys would come out painted black and blue with bruises. Like, what the fuck? Like, that is so fucked up. Oh, and it wasn't even just being beaten and whipped. There are accounts that the boys there were being sexually abused and sexually assaulted. And it's just, oh, if it doesn't make your skin crawl, I don't know what does. They do this because they believe that it's going to deter bad behavior through harsh punishment. And don't get me wrong, it probably worked on a few kids. They probably got so scared shitless that they decided to be good or bucked up their behavior, which I suppose, yeah, that's what the idea of it was. And it didn't work for Carl. And I'm pretty sure Carl wouldn't have been the only person that it didn't work for. We can, like, speculate that through his experience to alcohol at an early age, plus the beatings that he's already had, the botched surgery, like his prefrontal cortex at this point is just soup. So his decision making of like, okay, I'm being punished for this, I need to stop, that wasn't even a thought in his brain. He was just like, nope, I'm gonna just keep doing what I'm doing. I mean, the symptoms we also talked about, like rule learning and decision making, like they were gone too. Like I just said, his prefrontal cortex was probably just soup of mixed up stuff because it wasn't functioning as it should be in a normal person's head, right? Again, quote unquote, normal person's head. And because of this soup of a brain that Carl probably has at this point, this led him to arson. He ended up burning down the painting room. I mean, allegedly, this is what Carl says. It can't be proven, but this is what he says. So we could speculate that maybe Carl has a diagnosis of pyromania, right? He's a pyromaniac. Yes and no. The actual disorder of pyromania, it's very rare. It occurs in about 1% of the population. And the key feature of pyromania is setting a fire without a motive. And we could probably say that every time that Carl sets a fire in his life, there is a motive, which makes it different than being like a true pyromaniac, I suppose would be the way to put it. According to the article, prevalence and correlates of fire setting in the US results from the National Epidemiologic Survey on Alcohol and Related Conditions by Carlos Blanco et al. They conducted a face-to-face survey with more than 43,000 adults aged 18 and upwards who had a history of fire setting. Their results showed that the strongest associations with fire setting were with those with disorders often associated with deficits in impulse control, such as antisocial personality disorder, drug dependence, bipolar disorder, and pathological gambling. So let's take those and look at Carl. Again, we're not here to diagnose him, but this is all very interesting to kind of see what potentially was going on in Carl's brain. Now, there are no accounts of Carl gambling at this point. I mean, he might have been doing some form of gambling with the other children. I don't know. There are no accounts. We know that he definitely had no impulse control, so there are some deficits there. He was drinking alcohol before he went into Red Wing, so he could have become dependent on alcohol, which is a drug. And as for bipolar disorder, so I was looking up the symptoms, and Carl definitely did have some symptoms of bipolar, like being easily irritated or agitated, feeling pessimistic about everything, but he definitely didn't have all of them. Some of the symptoms included like having hallucinations. There are no accounts, or Carl never said anything about having hallucinations. He had no guilt. We will see that quite a lot. There's no guilt or remorse, and there definitely wasn't any of the feeling happy, elated, or overjoyed symptoms, and these symptoms came from the NHS website. So again, I'm not diagnosing him, but in my opinion, I don't think he had bipolar disorder, but probably more antisocial personality disorder. So we're going to talk about that because that comes up quite a lot in the different things that I researched about Carl Panzram and his psychology. It seems that most people think that this is at the very minimum what he had, but again, no one can diagnose him with it. But let's talk about it. So, according to the NHS website, and I was, you know, I searched up antisocial personality disorder to get a bit more of an understanding of it and whatnot. And I was going through the first web page, and this is a very, like, on the surface page explaining it. It doesn't go very deep. It's just a very, yeah, very basic on the surface explanation. And as I was reading it, I was like, this is literally explaining Carl Panzram. So I am going to read the page straight from the page. Plagiarism, right? But at some points I'll stop and we'll see how this relates to Carl. So, antisocial personality disorder is a particularly challenging type of personality disorder characterized by impulsive, irresponsible, and often criminal behavior. if that's not Carl Panzram, I don't know what is. Someone with antisocial personality disorder will typically be manipulative, deceitful, and reckless, and will not care for other people's feelings. Well, there we go. Carl lied. He was deceitful. Definitely reckless by drinking alcohol in the middle of town at 8 years old and starting fights with boys, and he definitely did not care for anyone's feelings later in life, as we'll come to find out. Like other types of personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder is on a spectrum, which means it can range in severity from occasional bad behavior to repeatedly breaking the law and committing serious crimes. We're going to get into the incarcerations of Carl Panzram in a bit, but again, it's Carl Panzram to a T. Now, psychopaths are considered to have a severe form of antisocial personality disorder. Put a pin in psychopaths because we are going to talk about that as well in just a second. So a person with antisocial personality disorder may exploit, manipulate, or violate the rights of others. Absolutely, Carl was a criminal. That's what you do when you commit a crime. You usually violate the rights of someone else. They have a lack of concern, regret, or remorse about other people's distress. He absolutely had no remorse. We'll get around to that in a second. They will behave irresponsibly and show disregard for normal social behavior, have difficulty sustaining long-term relationships. Now, we don't know if Carl had any relationships. We can say he never said he had any. In terms of friendships, though, he made a few pals along the way, but again, it wasn't long-term. I think his longest-term friendship was with Henry Lesser, the prison guard in Leavenworth in Kansas, who encouraged him to write his story. And that was probably the longest friendship that he had with someone. However, yeah, it wasn't long and it ended on a sour note. So we could probably say that Carl definitely fits that as well. Other symptoms, unable to control their anger. Absolutely, that fits Carl. A lack of guilt, we've talked about that. Blames others for problems in their lives. Now, on Carl's death day, when he was being hanged, he did blame his mother for bringing him into the world, so he does. And he also talks about the prison system, you know, in his, when he writes down his story, he talks about how, because of how he was treated throughout his life and in prison and whatnot, that turned him into a violent criminal. Now, yes, there may be some weight to that, absolutely, but there is at some time you have to take responsibility for your own actions, and Carl just never did that. He just blamed his mum for giving birth to him, and also the prison system and the prison guards. And the final symptom that was on NHS website was that they repeatedly break the law, which, yeah, that's Carl. They also go on to say, a person with antisocial personality disorder will have a history of conduct disorder during childhood, such as truancy, not going to school. Carl dropped out and he ended up not going from a very young age. Delinquency, for example, committing crimes or substance misuse. Absolutely, that's Carl. And disruptive and aggressive behaviors. Antisocial personality disorder affects more women than men. It's not known why some people develop antisocial personality disorder, but both genetics and traumatic childhood experiences, such as abuse or neglect, are thought to play a role. Now, we don't know Carl's genetic makeup, but absolutely he did have quite a traumatic childhood with being beaten up, the botched surgery, yada yada. And at this point, he's only 12, he's still in his childhood. So this is where we can see, you know, and he's going to Red Wing, so this is all part of that childhood experience that may be part of him developing antisocial personality disorder, if that's what he has. We don't know, we can't say. A person with antisocial personality disorder will have often grown up in difficult family circumstances. One or both parents may misuse alcohol, and parental conflict and harsh, inconsistent parenting are common. And as a result of these, social services may be involved with a child's care. I mean, there were no social services back in the 1900s, but there you go. And these type of difficulties in childhood would often lead to behavioral problems during adolescence and adulthood. So that is pretty much taken from the first page of the NHS website about antisocial personality disorder. And I just can see it all forming to Carl. The one line that I don't think fits to Carl is about the social services coming in because, like I said, there are no social services back in those days. So take your pin out of psychopathy that I told you to put in before. We're going to quickly talk about that. So I watched a great video on YouTube, and again, it's linked below, and it's by Dr. Todd Grande called Carl Panzram, Mental Health and Personality, Most Frightening Serial Killer Ever. And it's only about 17 minutes long. I do recommend going to watch it. It is fantastic. I did get a lot from today, like points to talk about today from watching that video. And it's quite funny on, well, not funny, but it was quite good. During the video, Dr. Todd makes a list of the least to the most frightening serial killers in prison. So not when they're out on the street, but, you know, inside the slammer. And it's based on how violent they were in prison and how cooperative they might have been or their behavior. So, like, he put down as his least frightening, David Berkowitz, you know, the son of Sam, because he did many interviews. He was very, you know, nice, and he spoke nicely, and he didn't cause any fights. He also put Harold Shipman, who's the Angel of Death, Kenneth Bianchi, the Hillside Strangler, which sounds a bit funny, but his victim type wasn't in jail. That's why these people, you know, are told, oh, well, they've been a role model inmate. It's because the victim type isn't in jail. I hate when people say that they've been a role model inmate, because it's like, or they've been let out on good behavior. It's like, fuck off. Like, they're meant to be on their best behavior in prison. Like, oh god, that. But also he puts Joel Rifkin, Joel the Ripper, and Ed Kemper, the co-ed killer, as like the least frightening people in jail. And again, it's because their victim type wasn't in jail. Next on the list was Jeffrey Dahmer, the Milwaukee cannibal. He was harmless, but he said some things in prison, and his victim type was in prison with him. It, you know, men, it was males, that's who he targeted. So he was a little bit more frightening. Then there was Ted Bundy. Now, even though his victim type wasn't in prison, he did have some violent tendencies and outbursts. Arthur Shawcross, the Genesee River killer, he was known to start a few fights in prison. Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, he definitely was a very scary dude. Richard Kuklinski, the Iceman, and then Carl Panzram, who, fun fact, doesn't actually have one of those serial killer nicknames, but he is considered the most sadistic and most terrifying American serial killer, and that's because he did start fights in prison, and he did kill someone in prison, and he did set fires. So inside, outside prison, he is probably the most frightening person ever. But back to what Dr. Todd said about psychopathy. Now, psychopathy is not a diagnostic category in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and this is partly because some people worried that a psychopathy diagnosis would stigmatize people too much, while others were concerned that clinicians would have difficulty in accurately assessing traits that are linked with psychopathy. It was, however, in the first two editions of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, but it was replaced in the third edition by Antisocial Personality Disorder. There it is, it pops up again. And this is because it focuses mainly on the behavioral aspects of psychopathy, such as aggression, impulsivity, and violations of others' rights, and minimally on personality characteristics like callousness, remorselessness, and narcissism. So as a result, only about a third of those diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder also meet the criteria for psychopathy. Now, there are two factors, like I've just said, there's behavioral and personality factors when diagnosing someone with psychopathy or calling someone a psychopath. And Dr. Todd in his video goes through these and relates them back to Carl. So factor one, which is behavioral with Carl, superficial charm. He wasn't a very charming person whatsoever. Grandiosity. He wasn't very grandiose, but he did have some grandiose ideas when he was in one of his many solitary confinement stints. He wanted to start a war between the UK and the US. So that is quite grandiose, but in terms of like his outlook on his own life, I mean, he did want to wipe out the entire human race as well. So I suppose that's quite grandiose as well. So he's a bit iffy on that one. But lying, manipulation, lack of remorse, shallow affect, lack of empathy, and failure to accept responsibility, that's all part of factor one psychopathy. Carl definitely fits those. Now in factor two, that includes sensation seeking, which we could say is arson, and the amount of crimes that Carl committed, that's definitely seeking sensation. Also, there's the lack of realistic goals. Carl had a goal of wiping out the entire human race, but it's not realistic whatsoever. Impulsivity, absolutely. Irresponsibility, poor behavioral control, early behavioral problems, juvenile delinquency, revocation of conditional release, and criminal versatility. Carl fits those. So even though you can't be diagnosed as a psychopath, we can definitely relate a lot of the traits of a psychopath to Carl, I think. So, but like I said, it got replaced in the DSM by antisocial personality disorder, so that does tell you something. Then looking at Carl's personality in terms of the big five, and this is usually what you learn in like Psych 101. I learned this in my first year of psychology. This is a five-factor model with the acronym OCEAN. So there's the five personality traits, and then within them are like subcategories, I suppose, or sub-traits that fit under this big umbrella. So the acronym is OCEAN, so O-C-E-A-N. The O is openness to experience. And on that scale, Carl probably sits about mid to high. He is creative, I suppose, with his crimes. He doesn't just kind of have one MO. He does a wide range of crimes. He is introspective, so that means to be thoughtfully reflective, and we see this a little bit, which is why this probably sits a bit around the midsection. We see this in the words that Carl writes about his feelings towards the prison system and the treatment from the guards, and then his outlook on humanity as a whole. Like, it is very much like reflecting on his own thoughts. And Carl is also intellectually curious, and we see this through his interest in philosophy. The C means conscientiousness, and Carl scores probably sits around a low. You know, he's not thoughtful, he's not organized or productive, he's not sensible or enterprising, but he is a little bit ambitious, again, with wiping out the whole of humanity. That's quite ambitious. E is extroversion, so again, mid to low. He's not friendly, he's not outgoing, but he wasn't shy, I guess you could say, and excitement seeking. He, like I said about the arson, and he also said that he prefers to be in cities rather than rural and being by himself. He didn't like being by himself, he liked being around people so that he could murder them and do very horrible things to them. The A is agreeableness, again, low. He had no empathy, no trust, not gentle or generous or cordial or tolerant or willing to comply. He probably has got the lowest low scale of agreeableness of anyone ever. There is nothing about him that could even be considered agreeable. And the N in the big five traits is neuroticism. And Carl, we have low and high parts, right? So Carl was never really depressed or anxious. He definitely wasn't a happy person, but he never shows kind of the signs of depression where you want to be left alone and you want to be, you know, don't want to get out of bed. Carl wanted to get out of bed every day, and that was to go and fucking do terrible and awful things. He was not able to resist temptation. We also see phases of Carl feeling invincible after his prison escapes or outwitting the prison system by changing names, using aliases, put a pin on that because we're going to come back to that, and committing arson within prison and not being caught for it. So he did have a bit of an ego. He had high testosterone level, and we see this as well. We talked a little bit about this after his escape from the reform school in Montana with Jimmy Benson, when the two of them go on to do stupid pranks and whatnot, and they're both about around the age of 15, 16 at this point, and they're going and doing stupid pranks, and this is actually a form of boosting their ego. They want to get a sense of achievement because it's not like they're going to go to school and pass a test or anything. You know, they have to do it by seeing pranks go through, if you get what I mean. So that's where he kind of gets his high testosterone level when it works. And yeah, so that's a little bit about Carl's personality, and that came from the video with Dr. Todd Grande. He kind of broke that down, and I just think it was really interesting. Take the pin out of aliases. Now, I mentioned in part two that this was going to be a talking point for us today, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about it a little bit right now. So I'm so bad at this like unscripted thing. I'm like, where am I up to? Am I here? Am I here? So I'm sorry if this is a bit chaotic, but I'm doing my best. So Carl used aliases for the purpose of beating the prison system, right? Not letting his crimes be linked together. Now, the US states didn't... The US states? The United States states. The states of the US. I don't even know how to word this. The states in America, there we go, the states in America didn't really talk to each other about crimes anyway, and they didn't do this for decades. You know, there was no database. We hear a lot about serial killers who were able to commit crimes in different states and get away with it, or only be charged for, say, one murder in one state, even though they murdered like 10 other people elsewhere, because there was no talking between the states, there was no database, there was no communication, no nothing for decades. And like Carl's story was back in the early 1900s, so that definitely was not around. But also, there is more to using aliases, and it is linked to schizophrenia, but in more of, I don't think it really fits with Carl, because in terms of schizophrenia, it's you fully believe you're someone else, or you hear you know, names and voices, like, you know, all the symptoms that come with being schizophrenic. And Carl didn't have this. He used aliases simply to not let his crimes be connected. But it also falls under antisocial personality disorder, because it's manipulation, it's deceitful, it's lying, you know, that's where it falls in. Now, one of Carl's most repetitive crimes was, trigger warning, we're going to talk about this, rape and sodomy. Now, as we talked in part two, I mentioned how Carl didn't rape his victims for sexual pleasure, right? He did this all for dominance and power. Now, most sexual assaults and sexual violence are perpetrated by men, and they typically arise within asymmetrical power dynamics, right? There is the dominant person, and then there's the victim, who's usually submissive by their being smaller, weaker, more vulnerable, that kind of thing. With Carl, though, however, when he came across those he raped, he didn't essentially know the power dynamic, because he was assaulting other men. So instead of trying to guess the power dynamic, Carl created it by going after whoever, no matter what they look like. He put himself at the top of the food chain, so to speak. Now, there was an instance where this happened that was quite astounding, and that was when Carl was in the boxcar with the two other homeless travelers, and instead of raping one of the two of them that were in there with him, they were found by a railroad brakesman, and Carl raped the worker. Now, in a societal hierarchy, the worker would be above the three homeless guys, right? So that's the power dynamic. The worker, the employed, contributing member of society, would be above the three homeless guys. So Carl flipped the script, and he put himself on top, and then he threw all three of them off. So it definitely wasn't for any kind of pleasure, except asserting himself as the dominant one. Now, one thing I will quickly touch on is when Carl went and joined the army, and I had a conversation on my Instagram post with @organizingdrunksquirrels, and we talked about Carl joining the army because this moment in Carl's life really confused me, made me scratch my head a bit, because he was a person who hated authority unless he was the one in charge. He was the dominant one, just as we've talked about. He couldn't go and rape everyone in the army and make himself the leader of the army. He knew he couldn't do that. So why the fuck is Carl joining an organization where you have to respect your superiors, you start at the bottom, you are told what to do, and you work your way up? Like, it makes no sense to me why Carl would want to do that. Now, when I was speaking to @organizingdrunksquirrels, they gave their viewpoint that they felt that Carl wanted to do better until he broke completely. You know, up until he joined the army, there was still a chance for Carl. Like, if he could just shake this issue he had with authority and make something of himself, maybe it would be okay. But he realized very quickly, like literally within an hour of joining, that he couldn't do that. He absolutely couldn't do that. He was also given a book about, it was called The Articles of War or The Art of War or something like that, that spoke about how you have to be the bitch boy when you join the army. You start at the bottom, you work your way up, but by doing, you got to do that by doing all the shit jobs. And Carl was like, fuck off, no way. So he ended up being imprisoned for a week, and then he was caught trying to leave his post, so he was thrown in for another month. It's like, but for me, it was, I just really don't understand why he did it. I put the points that maybe he just wanted a constant place to sleep. You know, at least he would always have a bed, he would be fed, or he thought about joining the army just so he could get guns and murder people. I really couldn't tell you why he joined the army, because I couldn't figure it out. But another great conversation that Organizing Drunk Squirrels and I had was also around the time when Carl met Captain A. Murphy at Oregon State Prison. Now, I know we are jumping all over the place. This is why I said this episode is going to be quite chaotic, and you definitely have had to listen to the last two episodes to kind of know what I'm going on about. But yeah, we're not timelining today. It's another really odd and weird thing for me to do, but there you go. So yeah, another great conversation we had was when Carl met Captain A. Murphy, who was probably the first person to show Carl some kindness and tried to understand how to treat Carl in prison. You know, he abolished the harsh punishments and the solitary confinement. He also let Carl leave the prison for the day as long as he promised to come back at dinner time. And what was so interesting was that when Carl was given the freedom, thinking, fuck yeah, I'm gonna run away and joke's on you, Spud Murphy, I'm gonna escape, he felt himself wanting to return back to prison, as he promised to do. But then in the instance where he failed to do that, Carl said he was ashamed that he had let the warden down, who had been so nice to him. Like, Carl was a fully grown man at this point, and Organizing Drunk Squirrels and I talked about how he actually behaved like a child in this point, how he acted like a teenager, a 14-year-old, who had done something wrong and was trying to hide from your parents. And I think it's interesting because when someone encounters trauma, sometimes they do get stuck at that age. You know, we talk so much these days, you know, it's all over my, you know, TikTok, and it's all over kind of my Instagram and whatnot. And it's videos of people who have gone through trauma, and they're talking about their inner child and how you have to heal your inner child to allow it to grow. And your inner child sticks at the age that you experienced trauma. And for Carl, this was at 14 years old, and that's why he reverted to act like a 14-year-old. You know, it happened when he was at Red Wing. You know, the trauma he went through there, after already his traumatic experiences at his house with his family. But then shortly after he left Red Wing, he was gang raped by four guys. Like, that's where his mind stopped developing. So this is why potentially why he felt ashamed that he let the warden down, even though Carl was at this point very strong, pretty much doing whatever he wanted to do anyway, and he felt like he let the warden down. It also, I think, it's what contributed to his antisocial personality disorder, if that's what he has, because again, I'm not diagnosing him today, but he seems to fit the bill quite well. But I am not, don't come at me for trying to diagnose him, because I'm not doing it. Now, speaking of Oregon State and incarceration, I did make a list of how many times Carl was incarcerated and was either released or escaped. So, Carl was incarcerated 14 times, two of them including reform schools. He was released 6 times and he escaped prison 6 times. He was bailed out once, and in his final incarceration, he was hanged. So obviously during his incarceration, we know that he was brutally tortured and whipped and treated absolutely horribly. We also know that he behaved horribly in prison. It was a very vicious cycle. But the biggest thing about Carl's imprisonment was solitary confinement. And this is the biggie. You know, we did talk about this in part 2, that in the Supreme Court case in Re Medley in 1890, so before Carl was even born, there were studies done into the effects of solitary confinement for the Supreme Court case. And just quickly recapping, it stated that inmates turned violently insane, some committed suicide, and those who handled it well still didn't regain efficient mental activity to be working members of society. Solitary confinement for long periods of time does way more harm than good. Even if you want to be punishing someone, if you put them away in solitary confinement for too long, you'll have more problems when they came out than when they went in. That's what I said in part 2. And, you know, more modern day studies have only confirmed this, with more evidence and more thorough studies have been completed. According to Dr. Sharon Shalev, who authored the book A Sourcebook on Solitary Confinement in 2008, said that the problems that solitary confinement causes may include anxiety and stress, depression and hopelessness, anger and irritability and hostility, panic attacks, worsened pre-existing mental health issues, hypersensitivity to sounds and smells, problems with attention, concentration and memory, hallucination that affects all senses, paranoia, poor impulse control, social withdrawal, outbursts of violence, psychosis, fear of death, self-harm or suicide. Research indicates that both living alone and feelings of loneliness are strongly associated with suicide attempts and suicide ideation. Additionally, many individuals who experience confinement become incapable of living around people. Now, we only know of one suicide attempt made by Carl, and this was when he thought that his own death sentence was going to be overturned. He didn't want to spend the rest of his life in prison, so he tried to end it himself and remain in control there. But, like, other than that, Carl pretty much showed every other issue that arises in social confinement, and he had really long bouts in there. You know, he was doing a week here, a month there. He did 61 days at one point, and, like, that didn't curve his behavior. That made it worse. So did the harsh punishments. You know, that certainly didn't help. He had no fear, and a lack of fear is also linked with psychopathy, which we now know is also linked with antisocial personality disorder. So because Carl was just so angry all the time, we could also say that he was a misanthropist, which is someone who has a general hatred, dislike, distrust of the human species. I think that's also Carl in a nutshell. You know, this also linked with his philosophical heroes. You know, he spoke how he was fascinated by the works of Immanuel Kant, Arthur Schopenhauer, and Friedrich Nietzsche. And, you know, we talked about them in part 2. They all had a very negative outlook on life, and Carl adopted it as well. He also had this, you know, end of humanity attitude about anyone and everyone. And that's because of how he was treated by people. He hated people. He wanted to get rid of people, even himself. It's not like he wanted to be the only person alive. He didn't want to live either. And because he had all these, you know, social issues, even though he preferred cities and being around other people, like I said earlier, it's because he wanted to kill them all. And that was actually one of two regrets that Carl did say he had in his life. He actually said that he had two regrets in life, and one of them was that he was regretful that he hurt animals, and this was back at the Kansas State Fair when he was a rider for the show, and he was fired because he was a dickhead to everyone, but also he had been seen, you know, kind of pushing around the animals and treating them quite horribly, and he actually says that he regrets that, so I suppose that's something. But his other regret was that he didn't succeed in wiping out the entire human race. You know? Nice one, Carl. So the last kind of point that I want to touch on is the prison system, and it's a huge one, and to be honest, it's probably going to be too hard to talk about. I'm already kind of going longer than I planned on this episode because it's just been so fascinating and interesting, and very different for me to sit here and be unscripted and kind of going off a whim. But just quickly about the prison reform system. So Carl is probably the only serial killer you'll hear that people feel sorry for sometimes. Now, every YouTube video I was watching or any kind of article that had a comment section, there was the majority of people that said, like, yeah, Carl would have turned out very differently if he was treated so much differently in prison, which it does hold weight. Absolutely. Like, it all comes down to his treatment in prison. And I think we can say that it was over the top, it was cruel and unnecessary. We absolutely can say that. But there comes a time and there comes a point, and I think Carl had the opportunity multiple times during his story that he had to take responsibility for his own actions. And he didn't do that. And that's, as we've learned, kind of comes under antisocial personality disorder as well. You know, he blames his mother and he blames the prison guards, right? And the prison system. There were multiple times in between prison stints where Carl was out by himself, and say when he was like on the Akista, his boat, or when he was just traveling on trains or whatnot, where he actually could have just kept to himself. He didn't need to actively seek out hurting people. He didn't need to do that. So to me, I say, well, no. That's the point, Carl, where you have to take responsibility for yourself. Now, if Carl's story was only he was the most violent criminal in prison because he only fought people in prison, and we found out, well, he was only fighting people in prison because he was being, like, tortured and abused in prison. Okay, that makes a bit more sense because it's confined to only prison. But once he's out, once he's either been released or escaped, he continues to do it. And to me, that's like, stop being an idiot. Because then he gets caught and he gets put back in that system that is flawed, absolutely. I'm not saying it was only Carl's fault. The prison system absolutely was and probably still is flawed. We've just come a long way since, you know, whippings and beatings and tortures, most of the world anyway. And that's what is so hard about this story, and that's why there is such a conflict about Carl's story. Now, I did talk about this in part two, but I don't know if I explained it right. But another thing that's hard to hear about Carl's story is, even though we went through everything and we heard about what he did, at the time when Carl was picked up for robbery or burglary and he would be in prison for a couple of months to maybe like a couple of years, he was being beaten, tortured, and whipped, but only for the crime of robbery and burglary. Like, that doesn't fit, right? Now, obviously, we know and Carl knew that he had actually already done some pretty horrific things like rape, assault, and murder, even though he wasn't being caught for that. He was being over-the-top punished for robbery. You know what I mean? Like, it just didn't fit. But it's hard to say that because we know that he did other things, and that's why it is so hard. Now, like I said, prison systems have come a very long way since then. They're still not fantastic. You know, we are still hearing about some pretty awful treatment of inmates, and, you know, prison conditions, overcrowding, all those types of things. And there is no perfect prison system. There is none. And you can't make everyone happy. I think we all agree that prison should not be a nice place for people to go, because you need to deter people from going to prison. So you don't want it to make it look like a resort or a little getaway, because it shouldn't be like that. But at the same time, it definitely shouldn't be like how it was when Carl was in prison. Now, I think the closest thing to how it should have been was at Oregon State Penitentiary, when Charles Murphy was the warden and he created jobs within the prison. Hard jobs, not very nice jobs that people would want to do on an everyday basis, but he grew to understand his more troubled inmates like Carl, and he tried to implement a different system that would work. He let Carl, who was a very fucking dangerous person, go out for the day as long as he promised to come back for dinner. Like, that was unheard of. That was completely shocking to everyone, you know. But I think that was the and I'm not saying that the prison system now should be all the prisoners get to go out during the day as long as you're back by dinner. But, you know, Charles Murphy took away harsh punishment. He gave the men in the prison jobs. He made them actually do stuff and contribute to society. It still wasn't a lovely place to be. They were still locked in cells at a night time, and they still had to adhere to a schedule, and they weren't getting fucking like 5-star restaurant food. They were getting nicer food, but not, you know, better food than anyone else. So I think that was the closest thing to how it should have been, and even potentially how it should be. I don't know. There is no answer to that. But because of Carl's story, more people took notice of prison systems and treatment of inmates, and a lot more prisons were looked into and changes were implemented because of Carl's story, which is like crazy that he was able to inspire change, even though he was a fucking horrible, horrific, frightening murderer himself. You know, that's why there's this conflict about his story. Now, we do know that the delegation, what's it called, like the Kansas Society, the society within Kansas that were against the death penalty, we know that that was already established. But again, because of Carl's story, because of the Henry Medley case, 1890, that you can't put someone to death and put them in solitary confinement. Because of these cases that came out, lots changed. And it's just fascinating to me that it came from the words of a fucking horrible person that people actually listened and said, well, we need to change how we run prisons and how we treat inmates. Now, it didn't happen overnight. It still took a long time, and probably in some places is still changing. But because of Carl Panzram, people actually decided to look into it. Even instead of going, hold up, he was a fucking horrible person, we don't need to listen to a word he says. People are recognizing that if he was treated differently in prison, he may not have committed as many crimes as he did. And Carl even said that. He was like, yo, if someone was just nice to me, I wouldn't be like this. So, food for thought, eh? That's kind of all the points I've got for today. I know it was a bit all over the place, and I know this episode's a bit longer than I actually had planned, but I wanted it to be that kind of sit-down, discussion-y type chit-chat, you know? But yeah, that's all I've got. It's a very weird episode. I can't wait to fully scripting an episode like the one I've got for us next week. Apologies once again for the ghosting over the last 2 weeks. Don't forget, the giveaway is coming up. We are only 2 weeks away from drawing names. So I will put another post up on Instagram for you guys to check out. If you're listening on Spotify, make sure you go to the Q&A box under the episode and type the word giveaway and you will get some entries. You can email me on coffeeandcrimepod@gmail.com. Tell me you want to enter the giveaway and we'll put you in. It's all going to go down in 2 weeks' time. I'm very excited. That is also going to mark the 1 year anniversary of Coffee and Crime Podcast, which is eek, amazing. But yeah, that is all from me. Please get in touch with me about your thoughts and feelings about this episode, about this wee little bonus. The psychology, it was fascinating. It was so fascinating to do some more research, and it did remind me of like my first year psychology university days. So it was a bit of fun. So I am going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much for tuning in. But until next time, be safe, be good, be better. And I will catch you guys next week right here at Coffee and Crime. Bye.